Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, Larry, we are back in our home places. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 96 of Registry Matters. How's it going?
I guess I'm still surviving. I'm still recovering from my trip.
Your 10-day gallivanting across the United States?
Yeah, I was down there with you people in the promised land of Georgia.
You people, eh? Any highlights that you want to cover? Were there any significant meetings that you attended?
I did attend a meeting of Georgia RSOL, and it was a good turnout.
There were 25 people, I think, as I counted.
Yeah, I think that was a pretty good turnout, and we had a nice meeting in an echo chamber.
It was spectacular. There's a room in, is it the White House? It's the Whisperer. Maybe that's in Congress. And you can stand on opposite corners and you whisper and you can hear on the other side. That's how this room was.
Well, it wasn't my selection. I had selected another room, but
let's not go over that.
Yeah. You guys didn't want to meet there.
I had nothing to do with that. All right. We have a gigantic amount of content. And before we dive into it, though, we have Brenda Jones joining us. She is the executive director of NARSOL. And she attended one of the days of the hearing of Galen Bachman and the civil commitment case. And I'll let you two go through a quick 5 or so minute summary of where things are, where we stand and all that. Welcome, Brenda.
Well, howdy.
Thank you, Brenda. The issue has been talked about on this podcast. I can't tell you which issue, episode number, but we've talked about civil commitment and our disdain for this process that takes place after people serve their time. They magically become in need of mental health care, and they get locked away in some cases, actually another prison facility, but something that resembles a little bit of treatment. And this is a case of a person who this is the second attempt by the state of Virginia to commit him. And he has a qualifying sexual offense, but they already had their trial 15 years ago to try to commit him. And then without committing another qualifying, or they call it predicate offense, without having committed another offense, they're going after a second bite at the apple. And can they do that? Absolutely. They can do that until they're stopped. And Brenda attended one day of the 2-week trial that's allotted for his commitment. So let's hear a brief synopsis of what you observed.
Sure. Well, the day I went, it was the second day of what's going to be a 10 days worth of hearings. And they were laying out evidence. The state had pretty much the entire day and spent the entire day laying out all of the actually brought in all the witnesses that would have been at Galen's original trial in 2003, for which he was convicted and served his 6.5 years. And they brought in former victims and former people involved with the issue, the investigator who entrapped him and, you know, caught him chatting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Brought all those people in, questioned, cross-examined, and read chat logs that he had made and all that stuff. So it was very emotional, very intense, and they're clearly setting up a picture of a person who's out of control and who's not going to be capable of controlling his actions. It didn't look good. And they've spent, I also spoke with Galen's mother, who's of course been attending all the hearings, checked in with her today. And she said pretty much this entire week has been taken up with witnesses for the state. Just a couple of people, I think yesterday, one of whom is heavily pregnant, and they were worried that she was going to pop right there on the stand. So they did have like a couple of hours worth of the defense bringing a couple of people on. So that's what I was seeing.
Well, Brenda, didn't ARSL release a statement dealing with the organization's position?
Yeah, we sure did. We put a statement out, and the focus there, as I know you are fond of saying, was that we were pointing out that the state has already tried Galen and found, you know, not only for the original offense, but whether or not he needed to go into civil commitment. There was a trial for that. The jury acquitted him at that time. And yet, because of a parole violation, they're taking that opportunity, probation violation, I think, actually, they're taking the opportunity to come back and try him again. And apparently, this is something that happens regularly in the state of Virginia. The state can keep bringing it back. You can get tried multiple times.
And when you say that, you mean on the civil commitment, that this is not the underlying case of his guilt or innocence from 2003. This is the attempt to commit him civil.
That is apparently what's supposed to be happening right now, is another attempt to commit him. But I am no legal person, but I sat in that courtroom and it sounded like they were trying to convict him again. It was just they were bringing all the people out that would have been at that original 2003 trial.
They are trying to make him look as bad as they possibly can. And it looks like the judge has been very accommodating to that in terms of ruling on motions. He's excluded anything.
Yeah, the defense were saying, we don't think this should be allowed. It's, I don't remember what the term is, judicata.
Yes,
did I get
enough.
That anywhere close? I got it right. They kept bringing that up and saying, we don't think this should be allowed, but the judge said, we're going to allow it. So every time they'd bring another witness up, the defense would stand up again and say, just registering that we're objecting to this. And the judge said, about the res judicata, overruled. And, they'd continue, and then the next one would come up, and they'd do it again.
And the sad thing about that was that in his pretrial motions, Galen's pretrial motions, he wanted to bring up that he had already been through a civil commitment process and the state had failed, and the court denied him the opportunity to bring up. But yet they get to bring up everything all over again. This case will, unless by some miracle he's not committed, this case will be an appellate case, and I anticipate that ARSL will be attempting to involve itself into it. We will deal with that when the appeal comes. But this is so important, because if you can continue to try to commit someone, you'll eventually succeed. And in closing, I'll say that.
Yeah.
Anytime there is a second trial, it always works to the state's benefit. It seldom works to the defense's benefit, because if you have a mistrial, of course, as a defense attorney, you're just excited as you can be that your client did not get acquitted. Convicted. Excuse me. You're excited that your client didn't get convicted. But the state gets to come back after they poll the jurors, after they figure out what the sticking point was, and they get to put on a better trial the second time around. And it eventually wears down, because eventually, except for a few people, you run out of money, and these trials are very expensive. So you go through a second, third trial, and the state eventually gets it right. So the state now knows what it didn't do in the first civil commitment, and they're making sure they don't spare any resource to convict him, or to commit him, I should say, this time around.
Yeah, and I will say they definitely were not sparing expense. They brought in one of the witnesses came all the way from Seattle. Another fellow was flown in from New York. A couple of guys from, somewhere out in the Midwest, all flown in for their moment on the witness stand to share. So those people were flown in on the state's dime. They were, the hotel was on the state's dime. I don't know if they were paid to do it, but, their costs were covered.
There generally is a small witness fee, but usually that's not the deciding factor. It's all those other expenses. But the state of Virginia is fully intent on committing this man. And there will be an appeal if they succeed, because I can't imagine, as well connected as he is, he's going to say, well, I guess they won fair and square. Of course he's going to appeal.
They will appeal. And I did at least briefly connect with Galen's attorneys and let them know that ARSL was interested in being involved.
So Well, that's really good. And we're going to stay on top of this as far as registry matters.
Excellent. Thank you, Brenda. Anything else you want to plug before
we
let you go?
You are welcome. Nope. I'm good. I'm just happy to be here and I'll listen in.
Thank you. And appreciate all of your efforts with all the different things that you do. Too many to number. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks.
Larry, are you ready to get into all these crazy articles?
One of the biggest things that she does that doesn't get recognized is she puts up with me.
Man, I'm with you on that. Man, I will send her all the fruit baskets necessary to help her tolerate all that.
Because
I have to put up with you too, so I can appreciate it.
I get agitated. I have to vent, and she's the one that hears my venting and when I'm agitated.
Larry, this is almost like, let's see, it's what, 3-ish or something weeks before Halloween, and the Halloween articles have started in definite numbers. You ready? We have like 2 or 3 Halloween articles tonight.
Well, the first one is the sting.
Yes, because this article comes from floridapolitics.com. Policing the police. Did Sarasota sheriff go too far in undercover sexting? I know that we like cover these same subjects over and over and over again, but here we have it where cops go into what are presumably adult oriented dating sites, whatever that be, Plenty of Fish, Grindr, whatever. And somebody strikes up a conversation with, they assume to be an adult, and then the police are posing as the person trying to date. And then they say, oh, by the way, I'm 14. And your point has always been, well, why didn't they stop the conversation? And why didn't you? But whatever. So there's no victim, though. Who is the victim in this case other than the intent to commit the crime?
Well, I want to clarify. My point is that from a legal perspective, they should stop the conversation. But I'm not forgiving and giving the police a pass here. I've been unequivocal in my criticism of the police for doing this. And you actually didn't frame it up exactly the way it is. The police create adult profiles, and then after a conversation ensues, then they magically become underage. So it's a bait and switch.
Right. And, I'm with you. Yeah.
And then the person, there's a such thing as fantasy chat, and the person who is in the chat room in an adult site, thinking they're talking to an adult, and then the person says, oh, by the way, I'm 15. It's possible that you could reasonably believe that that person is engaging in a fantasy chat. Unless you have a live visual, you don't know what's on the other end of that keyboard.
You know the TV show called 21 Jump Street? It's pretty old.
I've heard of it. Yes.
So these are like adult detectives, and they put them in a school. At least that's what I remember as being the storyline. But even in the article, they say the reason why they can't get any like kid-looking detectives, because there aren't any kid-looking detectives that are like 21-year-old detectives that look like they're 15s that they could actually use to be an active participant. You know, you got some 50-year-old hairy dude saying that my name is Melissa. Doesn't work out real well if they want to have some sort of live chat.
That does not. But what you have here in the case of this particular individual who we've talked about suicide, he went and committed suicide after he showed up. He was 62 years old, and apparently in the Great Recession, he lost everything or lost the bulk of everything. But his name is Hamed Keshmaran, which I would suspect that's Middle Eastern.
Fair.
And the culture in the Middle East is the shame factor on a family is you brought dishonor to the name.
Yes.
And he would have felt that because of the shame that would go with being arrested for this type of an offense. So he committed suicide, but he's not the only one. There have been documented in this article. There's been a number of cases. So this was done in Sarasota, Florida. For those of you who don't know, it's just south of Tampa. You have Bradenton, Sarasota area. And this was in Sarasota.
What about the argument that I saw some people make that given that there are legitimate crimes being committed as far as like sex trafficking or some sort of abduction kind of things that police could focus their efforts on. Is this just the proverbial low-hanging fruit that this is something of an easier kind of like entrapment? They can do it from their home office and snag someone and make headlines?
That is my opinion. That's exactly what it is. This is glitzy. You set up a sting operation, and they're manpower intensive, but you do the takedown like they're a violent criminal. They take down these old guys as if they're about to blow up Iraq or something. It's ridiculous with overwhelming force. But again, if you citizens out there did not give them overwhelming force, they would not be able to employ overwhelming force. So we have to look at the mirror at ourselves. When the cops keep saying they need more and more police officers, as crime continues to plummet, we have to knock on our head and say, hello, why do we keep falling into this argument that they need more and more resources? Of course they don't need more and more resources. Crime is going down.
I think we have an article about that tonight too.
the overwhelming manpower that these things take, but they also generate good media. This is great for TV. It really is, and it's great for elected officials, particularly sheriffs. Primarily, I don't know of any jurisdiction where sheriffs don't run. There may be some where they're appointed through some process, but generally, a sheriff is elected, and they're very close to the people. And this is very appealing to the people. I mean, they're taking, as far as the average citizen's concerned, they're not getting into the nuances of what we're talking about tonight, of the police misconduct. The average citizen, as far as they're concerned, these people are standing between adults who are trying to meet minors. These adults had no intention of meeting a minor until the police pretended to be one.
Ryan,
and that should
chat.
Outrage you.
Go ahead. Let me finish.
That should outrage everyone that the police are pretending to be something they're not to try to create a crime that doesn't really exist in large numbers. So go ahead.
Ryan in chat says the number of police that came to my door was around 30. It was insane. 30 cops for a nonviolent, extremely docile person.
That confirms what I'm saying. They bring in massive, massive manpower. And like this, and what do you suppose your neighbors think when there's 30 officers? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking out your front window out of your door and you see 30 cops all pulling up, like, I mean, you think that Osama bin Laden lives across the street?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's something where there's a deliberate. They know your background. By the time they come to do the arrest, they've run your criminal history. They've talked to people that you're acquainted with. They've done surveillance by the time they even though these things, generally they know if you watch To Catch a Predator, they knew a fair amount about each person before they did the takedown.
And there was that.
Because they usually engage in chat for several days.
Yeah, there was a girl, I'm pretty sure it was California, but she was held hostage in the backyard for 18 or something years by a convicted sex offender. And probation never went and thought about looking in the backyard, and she was just in a tent, something like that. A legitimate case. There was another one, I think, in Chicago, where three girls were shackled to the floor in the upstairs of the house, and eventually one of them like snuck out and made a big stink. I mean, there are legitimate like things that the police could do, but they focus on this stuff and not just have one or two officers go, "Hey, mister, maybe you should come downtown with us." But no, they're gonna show up in a whole SWAT van and come out in tax squad with snipers on the roof of opposing houses.
Well, this article is very good read for those.
It is.
Even the prosecutor expressed a little bit of concern about the techniques. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you have the prosecutor saying perhaps we need to rethink this, and even Sheriff Judd, who'd done so many of these, they said Sheriff Judd's not doing them anymore in his jurisdiction.
And
I forget what county in Florida he's in.
To focus on a point from us being like actionable, is it? Do we then go to the sheriff and go, "Hey, are you going to continue doing these things? Otherwise, I'm not, or excuse me, if you continue to do these things, I'm not voting for you." Is that the only tool that we, the people, have to fight this?
Well, it's not the only tool. We have the courts, but the courts are not very sympathetic to when you argue entrapment. The entrapment is whether there was a predisposition you're not being entrapped if you're trying to commit a crime. And the court generally lets that issue go to the jury, whether or not you were entrapped. And once you continue the dialogue, and this is where my concern comes in, because once you continue the dialogue with a person who's magically become 14 or 15, then they say, "Well, you had the predisposition." And the jury feels, "Well, I'm a parent, you know, I wouldn't want somebody out there perving on my kid online." Well, the thing is, there was no one perving on your kid online.
There was no kid.
It was the police creating a fake scenario. There was no one perving. The person that was perving on your kid was actually in an adult chat room, but that goes over their head. Of all they do is go into a defensive mode about, this is what I want. This is what I want my sheriff doing. Of course I want my sheriff protecting the kids.
Just one last thing before we move on. I often think about radar traps to be something of entrapment. I think that's a bullshit way to get somebody caught for speeding, but you were already doing the speeding. You were breaking the law. And then there's a cop sitting there waiting for you to cross their path. At least you were in the act of committing something that would be construed as breaking the law. That's the only thing that I can think of that is, I mean, like, what is the Walmart greeter? Like, drop something in your pocket as you walk into the store and then they snag you for shoplifting? That would be entrapment, I guess. I'm trying to come up with something that is like a relatable, something that is, you know, that we have in a normal society, like something that we can frame a reference to that would be normal and outside of this. This is very obscure and esoteric.
Entrapment is when the person, the law enforcement officer, encourages you to commit a crime that you were not thinking of doing. When they come to you and say, hey, you know, I kind of got scheduled down this bank and I kind of know when the van comes in. And I'm thinking we can make out like a bandit. And you say, oh, okay, I'm in. And they say, oh, by the way, here's my badge. I'm the police.
Yeah.
You weren't predisposed to commit that crime until it was offered and the inspiration and the idea was planted on you. But if you happen to this is where all the people who get caught in prostitution stings, are you a cop? Doesn't make any difference because you're out there looking for illegal sex to hire, which is illegal in most of the United States, and asking them if they're a cop, you're predisposed to hire for illegal sex. And you say, are you a cop? That does absolutely nothing.
They have to tell you,
but
don't
people,
they?
People are convinced that that's entrapment. That is not anything resembling entrapment.
There, if you remember back to the TV show Miami Vice, where the I can't remember their name, Sonny and Tubbs. It was Sonny Crockett and something Tubbs. They would pose as big drug dealers, and they would go and they would make the trade. And once the money had exchanged and the other person has the drugs, then they would go arrest them. But I mean, they were cops doing the deed, but they were actually delivering a product and exchanging money for said product.
Yes, but they weren't encouraging the person to commit the crime. They were merely responding to
correct. But, so the already
but that's
existing
where the
demand.
The entrapment comes in when they provide the motivation and the idea. And when people try to use this entrapment defense, it never works. Or at least I haven't seen it work. And I've been involved in probably a half dozen cases here in my state where lawyers have had the brainstorm that they're going to try entrapment defense. And I tell them, well, it's not a good defense. Right. Because once you continue to engage after you've been informed, unless you say, now look, this, we are having a fantasy chat.
Okay.
I know you're not 37. I mean, I know you're not 15 years old. Yeah. You're actually 37. You're a big old fat cop and you're sitting there trying to entrap me. But for purposes of this fantasy, you're 15.
Yep.
but they continue to engage the person. And I know I'm going to take ridicule from this because someone's going to say that I don't understand, but that's not a good defense. It's practically all you have when you've shown up to the meeting and you've got the condoms and you've got everything that indicates that you want to have sex with a minor, but it's not a defense that works.
All right, let's move on over to a New York Times article, An Explosion in Online Child Sex Abuse, What You Need to Know. This, to me, my take is that this has almost entirely to do with internet usage and sharing, not really so much in the public eye, but using private messaging apps to share. And it says a record 45 million illegal images were flagged last year alone. And they don't necessarily say exactly where all of those came from, but they do say at the current time, nearly 2/3 of those are coming off of like Facebook Messenger. Wow. That is a lot of naughty child images being passed around.
It is, and it's one of those things where we're gonna have to the technology, I suppose, hasn't completely caught up with the laws, and the technology don't match because you've got to have people, I think, still to review these. Do they have a computer that'll do the initial scan before a human has to review these? I don't understand all this stuff.
I would struggle to see how you could. Okay, so you have an adult. Let's take I can't think of her name at the moment. You have there's a famous actress at this point. She runs around on bikini on Instagram all the time, And so let's just say the picture is, I don't know, 90% flesh, but she still has a bikini on, so it's not porn. You just change the context. I don't know how the computer can, I don't see how you could determine that level of intent of an image with computer algorithms yet. Just like the Supreme Court said forever ago, they said, well, I don't know how to define porn, but I know it when I see it. And to me, this feels like the same thing because, you know, it is that time of year. The most popular costume almost every year to be bought is the little Catholic schoolgirl outfit, the little plaid skirt and the tall white stockings. Somehow that is in our culture as being the most sexy, hot, popular costume that someone, that an adult could wear.
Mm-hmm. So, well, do we truly have the wherewithal to deal with this if it's exploded to 45 million? And what's the time frame on the 45 million last year?
It says last year.
45 million.
Last year alone. I wonder, from your point of view of the ability for us to have encrypted chat with people. WhatsApp uses a very high-end encryption. There's another program called Signal. There's Telegram. There's a bunch of them. And then now Facebook has reported that they're going to use encryption. And I'm not trying to get to the technical side for you, but from the privacy side of it, that you and your boss have the, I believe that you have the right to have non-public communication between the two of you, whether that is to talk about a case, whether that's to share illegal images, you have the right to have those things private. Where does the legal side come in for the government to say, Facebook, don't do it, and then actually then impose that they can't do it?
I don't know. That's one of those questions that Justice Scalia is going to have to answer.
Because I use one, and I don't use it. I use it with a handful of people. I use Signal, and it uses a ridiculously, as far as I know to this point, it has not been, the encryption has not been broken. And they even deployed the same encryption technology inside of Skype as well. And I do not think that you can't make a backdoor on it without breaking the encryption. And as we have the Fourth Amendment, and you have the right to have private conversations with people for not illegal purposes. And if they break it for their purposes, then they break it for everybody.
Well, therein is going to lie the problem. Are you going to be able to detect the criminal, which is not, that's not, you don't have the right to share images that are forbidden.
Of course.
Are they going to be able to have the technology that will be able to see into these encrypted conversations? I don't understand any of that.
Yeah, I understand. And the math, as far as I know, that's what it comes down to. Like the math is amoral, and I don't know if there's a better word than that. But, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, and I don't care whether you're white, black, Christian, Muslim, Hindu. It doesn't matter. And that's what the encryption is. It either works or it doesn't work. It's either breakable or unbreakable. And it doesn't care. So, you know, you can use a pencil as a deadly weapon, but that doesn't make the pencil inherently bad. The pencil just is.
So, well, we just need to turn off the internet.
I'm with you. All right, then. So the internet is off and, well, shit. You know what, Larry? That means the podcast won't go through. Damn it. Well, let's move over to Kansas.com.
Thank you, Al Gore.
Yes, of course, Al Gore. He invented the internet, so he says. That was, can you clarify that? He did. I know he didn't say it, but what was the misconstrued idea out of that?
In some people's view, he took more credit than he deserved. He was in one of the committees that they had he was a chair of one of the committees that dealt with communications, and he was a big proponent of the internet. And as the internet exploded in the 90s, when Bill Clinton became president in 93, there was like 100,000 websites. And then by the time he left in 2001, it just had exponentially exploded.
Yeah.
And Gore said something about that he had been instrumental in the internet. And the people who were Gore haters said that he's taking credit for inventing the internet, and he wasn't doing that.
Well, just for at least my understanding, the quick history is DARPA created, which is the Defense Advanced Research Project, something or another. Anyway, it's a military arm, and they created what was called DARPANET, and then colleges started using it, and they started sending messages around, and then it turned into the big full-blown internet. Good stuff.
That is That is my recollection, but it came from that big old bad government spending.
Damn it.
That everybody hates, but that spends off beautiful technologies that people profit with in the private sector. But yeah, the internet was a government creation.
All right. Well, then back over to Kansas.com and the Wichita Eagle. Lifetime sex offender registration for 14-year-old rapist constitutional, says the court. And you say that this is funny, Larry.
Well, I don't know if funny would be the word that most people, but it's a great case for people who like to dive into cases, because all the stuff that I pontificate about is in this case. And we're going to have a copy of it that has appropriately been highlighted in the show notes.
All right.
If I can figure out how to get back to my files, they're gone.
Uh-oh.
Where did they go, Andy?
See? You had other problems. This is not, somebody came in and sabotaged your computer, and we are all about some conspiracy theories. The NSA, because of the popularity of this podcast, and it's going to bring down the registry and all that, they have sabotaged your machine.
They have, but I found it now. So it's only a 12-page opinion, and it's out of the Kansas Court of Appeals. And the juvenile sex offender is unhappy that they changed the registration requirement of what was going to be a 5-year requirement for him at the time he was adjudicated to a lifetime requirement. And so he put forth a plethora of arguments, and they were all shot down, every single one of them. And so I started by underlining or highlighting on page one, line one, the syllabus of the court: we presume statutes were constitutional and resolve all doubts in favor of a statute's validity. And I know when I say that, people get so angry. They say, well, Larry, there he goes again, defending the statute. No, I'm just relaying the court's interpretation and jurisprudence. I'm not telling you that that's the way I'd like it to be.
Right.
But it says determine whether, line five, to determine whether the legislature's statutory scheme is punitive as applied to a juvenile offender, we must use the intent effects test adopted in State versus Peterson, which was a 2016 case decided by the Kansas Supreme Court. And they went through all that, and we find that the registration requirement is not punishment as to a juvenile, and it's not part of the juvenile offender sentence, so it does not violate the constitutional provisions in ours, the juvenile's name raises. And the relevant statutes impose on the defendant the duty to register, making any lack of magistrate court's authority to do so immaterial. Finding no error, we affirm. This also is, I pontificate about bringing the case correctly in a declaratory judgment. This was brought in a criminal setting through an appeal. He pled guilty, stipulated to facts that he had the adjudication, that he had committed the offense, and because he was charged with failure to register. He moved out of a shelter or some sort, and he did not update, and he pled guilty to stipulated facts, and preserving the right to appeal, and he did the appeal in a criminal case. Not the best way to go about it, folks, because the criminal court's not really set up for you to build a civil evidentiary record. So as you read through this opinion, you go through, and he alleged that it violates the cruel and unusual punishment of the Eighth Amendment. He says it violates the cruel and unusual punishment of the Kansas Bill of Rights. He says it violates the ex post facto clause of the U.S. Constitution. And he said it was an illegal sentence because it was imposed by the magistrate judge without any authority to impose registration. He got shot down on all of that. As you read through, I think I highlighted here around page nine where he did not build the record. The lawyer, it says, to show the burden that CORA, which is Kansas Offender Registration Act, registration requirement has placed on him, NR relies on two affidavits his attorney reviewed during the hearing on his motion to dismiss, and one from his fiancée. But NR never moved to admit these affidavits either at the hearing or on his motion to dismiss or at trial. So the district court never admitted them as evidence. Although NR has included the affidavits in the record on appeal, the court cannot consider the evidence because it was not admitted at trial. That sounds like almost a rookie mistake, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Huh. And you said you said this even pre-show. You said to make a constitutional challenge during a criminal trial is a bad idea?
It's not set up for you to build the best evidentiary record. It's not a bad idea. If you could get rid of a pending charge on a constitutional claim, you'd be a fool not to. But it doesn't provide the form for building the – and in fact, I think Brenda's still on here listening. And the Maryland appellate courts said to people who were bringing the challenge through criminal cases, please stop doing this. Bring the challenge in a declaratory judgment if you want us to seriously consider it. Because there you have a chance to build a record below. And he would have had a chance to have built the record below if he had been, but it maybe he had no money. I suspect he didn't have any money because he said he was staying at some kind of shelter and they terminated him for failure to comply with the program. So he probably didn't have any money and he did the best he could within the criminal case. But now we have appellate case law out of Kansas where a person tried to say that juveniles are different and they relied on three Supreme Court decisions saying that juveniles are not fully developed where the U.S. Supreme Court has said juveniles should be treated differently. And the Kansas court shot all that down. They said, well, that's true in the case of punishment when extreme punishments are being handed down, but this is not a punishment. This is simply
civil
a regulatory
scheme. Right, yeah. Isn't this another one of those cases where that can be flipped on its head and used in our favor, though, because of the extreme levels of disability that the registry does create? It's not just that the law enforcement knows, but the
he didn't build that into the record. Hmm. So that's why the declaratory judgment route is the best way to go.
They should have consulted you first, I think.
Well, they may have not had the resources. This may have been an overworked public defender that had to do the best he or she could with the resources they had.
Are you then saying that you're not completely, like, notorious nationwide? You're not the infamous Larry that knows all the things about the registry stuff?
Well, I would have been happy to consult if I had been asked. But if you tell an attorney that has a client to represent that you shouldn't be doing this, and they say, well, look, I work for the public defender. I can't do a civil action as a public defender. And I'm trying to do everything I can to keep my client from being sentenced as a felon in violation of the Kansas Offender Registration Act. Can you help me with that? That's what I want. That attorney doesn't want to hear all my song and dance about we have to look at the better, greater cause, and we have to – they don't want to hear that. Their job is to defend that particular person. He was representing NR. He wasn't representing the whole state of Kansas, all the juveniles in Kansas. That was not his problem. His problem was NR.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, then I guess we should move over to Slate. And I'm going to try and build the case that this is relevant to us. Domino's wants to slice away at the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I think the best way that I can say this is that Domino's wants to make it, they want to avoid having to make their website accessible to people with particularly visual disabilities. Charles, a listener of ours and a Patreon supporter, he is visually impaired. And he has to use all kinds of add-on technology like screen readers and other things so that he can navigate websites the way that sighted people do without even thinking about it. And Domino's case is that they don't want to spend the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, which sounds exorbitantly small compared to what their gross revenue is. And they don't want to do this. Now, here's where it's tangentially related to us. Our people are often impaired from using the internet in various ways. So if the Americans with Disabilities Act provides regulations to make it so that bathroom doors are so wide so people in wheelchairs can get in and out and ramps and other things of that nature, and that is the idea is that these impairments, these barriers make it so that they have a hard time making it through what our lives are more easily traversed, then doesn't that then say that people on the registry that have limited access to the internet, like, yes, that's obviously an impairment? There, that's my case.
Well, denied.
Damn it!
Overruled.
You suck, Larry. is that a fair case to be made?
It's stretching.
Is it really?
This whole thing is a stretch.
You think so?
Now, Oh, absolutely. It's a stretch. With Scalia, you'd have this would be a no-brainer for him. He wouldn't even have to read the briefs, as he said the last time we had him on, that he wouldn't even have to read the briefs. Now, this is not my personal view, so I don't need hate mail. looking at a constitutional, just merely at the Constitution and what the Constitution guarantees you, the Constitution doesn't guarantee you that every business will treat you fairly and that they will accommodate you. The Constitution places no such burden on business. And in fact, in a capitalist system, capitalism is designed for the law of supply and demand to dictate business decisions. So what we have here is we have a public policy issue. It would be a good public policy if more accommodations were made and people with disabilities could more fully participate. We would have a healthier society. And that goes across the board, not just people with disabilities physically. It would go across the board with people who are broken individuals that are homeless, sleeping on the tents. We would be a healthier society if we did the things to help them fully participate. But is it Domino's responsibility to do that, or is it society's responsibility to help folks who are struggling? I wouldn't think it would be Domino's responsibility to go out and employ these people that are homeless, that are living in the tents in San Francisco, would you? And that's a societal problem.
Yes, I agree with that. But from the technology side of it, in this specific situation, it's trivial doing this kind of work to make it so that it is more. It costs money. I get that, but it's also work they only have to do once and then maintain. For them to make this so that people with visual impairments can view the site, same as society as a whole decide that we don't want people dealing with this. We say that we want there to be ramps so that people in wheelchairs can make it into buildings and so forth. But I guess from the Scalia side, like, there's no constitutional protection for that. We as society decide that we don't want those people to have those barriers.
That is correct. And the Americans with Disabilities Act can be updated to require Domino's. Right now, the position Domino's is taking is it's about physical barriers. It's
yes.
about physical barriers. And therefore, we don't have a physical barrier. This is a technological barrier. It's not
yes.
a physical barrier. And therefore, you know, go pound sand. If you want to change the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's fine. Go ahead and do that. That's what public policy discourse is all about. And then they would be able to come in and make the argument about what the cost, just like they did in 1990. I believe it was 1990 when the ADA passed. I know George H.W. Bush was president. And I know Ted Kennedy and some of the leading Democrats worked in bipartisan fashion, your famous bipartisanship, to get that to the president who signed it. And here we are, what, 90 to 2000, about 30 years later. And what did they say, 25% of the schools in New York are ADA
yeah.
accessible from
yes.
physical barriers, and like 30% of the subways are ADA accessible. So the government itself hasn't made great strides in 3 decades.
Yeah. Yeah, the last paragraph describes those things. Nearly 30 years after the ADA was enacted, less than 20% of NYC public schools are fully accessible to children with disabilities, and only 25% of subway stations are wheelchair accessible.
So we have a long way to go,
right?
But what needs to be happening is that this needs to be resolved in the public policy debate. We don't want our judges legislating from the bench, do we, Andy?
I'm inclined to say no, and then I just would revert back to that the American people are jerks for not making this just the standard, that this is what is expected of you being part of our society. But that's not what it
right.
is.
But our audience tends to be on the conservative side. You do not want judges that have on a black robe to legislate from the bench and to interpret into the Americans with Disabilities Act these requirements would be a stretch. And Scalia would tell you, it's a no-brainer. I don't have to read the briefs.
Right.
The ADA did not contemplate the change that has happened in society. In 1990, people weren't thinking about a virtual accommodation. They were thinking about physical barriers. They were talking about ramps and stairs and elevators.
Yeah. Well, then let me ask you this question.
So that people can...
I have two questions. Are judges super legislators?
Well, it depends on what you believe. If you believe if you believe in a limited role of the judiciary, they're not. If you believe that the courts are, exist to save us and to guide our public policy, then yes, they're super legislators. But I tend to actually be, I don't want judges imposing their personal agenda.
And my second question is very much related. Are courts roving tribunals?
They are not roving tribunals. A dispute has to be brought to them for a review, and this dispute was brought to them, and it's made its way to the Supreme Court, and they haven't granted cert yet, have they? They're considering it.
I do not believe it has made it very far. No.
The
subtitle of it is the possibility that the Supreme Court might decide blah blah blah. So yeah, so that's they're seeing if SCOTUS will grant cert.
But in terms of the issue we face, we're facing banishment from it's different when you're told you cannot access these platforms, that you're forbidden.
Yeah.
Charles can access it all he wants to. He just can't fully. If you can't see, you can't use it. And I don't know all the various tools that they use for visually impaired, but he faces no prohibition whatsoever. Maybe he does depending on what state he's in, but this is not a barrier at all. This is a company saying, I'm not doing this.
The tangentially related part was there being the policy prohibition from our side of the equation, where like your handler says you can't use the internet, versus it being functionally unusable because it's not designed for you without having sight. Six one way, half dozen the other. The end result is essentially the same, that you can't use it.
Yeah, but the visually impaired person, assuming they're not on the registry or have some prohibition or the probation officer, They're not forbidden, nor do they face prosecution. They just simply cannot use it because it's not user friendly.
Yep.
Does a business have a responsibility to make everything user friendly?
It seems like it would be in their interest to make it, but then again,
do they have some responsibility to make everything user friendly?
I feel that you're trapping me on that question.
You don't want the big old bad government. I mean, that's the problem with our economy, Andy, is we've got too much intrusion and overregulation, and the government is always sticking its nose in everything and telling businesses what they have to do. That's the problem why America is not competitive.
But the way you framed that question to me was that does the business hold some responsibility? And as a part of society, then they do bear some of that responsibility, don't they?
Well, if you're a good corporate citizen, you would take into account those factors. And Domino's has said we've taken them into account.
but then we can flip the equation over and go, they are just capitalist driven, and they have the obligation to their shareholders, so they're just optimizing for profit. So F the people that have the disabilities, because like they're an insignificant portion of our business that it matters.
That's what they're probably saying, and we could express our disapproval with. I mean, I haven't ordered a pizza from Domino's in 30 years, so they won't feel one way or the other from me. But you certainly could voice your approval or disapproval boycotts or
spend your dollars elsewhere.
People tried a few years ago to boycott Chick-fil-A, and their sales zoomed beyond all imaginary proportions that they couldn't even handle it. So I'm not a big fan that boycotts are going to achieve the result. But
agreed. All right. Well, our first of two appeals articles tonight is Kamala Harris' take on policing gets wrong. And my takeaway, like my short version of the story, is that she is trying to revamp the already existing police force to do kind of sort of what they do. But we're going to slap a layer of nice colored paint on it. I guess we're going to put lipstick on a pig. That seems to be the way that this article is characterized, that it's not an actual policing reform. It's a policing kind of makeover, so to speak.
Well, I think it's a little more aggressive than that. As I read through it, she wants to, she pledges to step up the use of the Department of Justice to bring pattern and practice cases against local police departments. Now, the Obama administration was doing that.
Yes.
And you had these consent decrees that were entered into with the Department of Justice and local police, including my city of Albuquerque. But under President Trump, those enforcement actions have ceased. So the Trump administration believes that we should just trust the police to do what's best, and that they're the best to oversee themselves. And if there's any problem, of course, the locals will take care of it, and they'll do the right thing. I'm not convinced that the locals are able to do the right thing.
Yes.
Yeah. When you're dealing with something as powerful as the police, I'm not convinced that. I mean, should they do the right thing? Of course they should, but I'm not convinced that they can do the right thing. So Kamala is wanting to bring that practice back. What she's trying to do, in my opinion, here is she's trying not to come across as a radical. The Democratic field of candidates has gotten so far off, and so radical, and so extreme, that she's trying to move them a little bit back toward the center. and she doesn't want to sound like the ones who want to be so far out left wing that they're going to get 34% of the vote in a general election, which is what's going to happen if one of the real extreme ones gets nominated.
Right.
They're going to suffer a 49 state landslide defeat.
Oh, but, boy, that would be awesome.
I actually see this as a positive. I mean, she's actually talking about it, and she's actually put forth a plan, and it's not aggressive enough for some, but I see this as a positive. But according to the article, what's missing from Harris's package and procedural justice more generally is any real interrogation of the enhanced scope of policing that has occurred over the last 40 years, which means how many that says they arrest 9 million people in 2016 for nonviolent offenses, which it goes back to my argument. We've got too many cops on the street with too little to do. And so they're able to arrest people. So she's not going after the over-policing. She can't do that because the police are so strong, they will turn on her with a vengeance if she does that.
Gotcha.
So politically, she can't go any further than she's gone. I mean, folks, we do live in a political system. and that's the way we run our country. It decisions are political.
Yeah. All right. And then our second appeals article, and I shouldn't say appeals, it's the appeal. Oklahoma Department of Corrections agrees to move qualifying, whatever that means, death row prisoners out of tomb-like unit. Larry, they're living in, these people are in death row, and I have a great question for you here after I do this. 44 of the 47 death sentence prisoners are in permanent solitary confinement, and they said it's about the size of a parking space, and there's no windows. There's probably a window on the door, but there's no outside light. They get treated pretty shittily. And so this looks like they're going to move many, many, many of them into something that would resemble more humane treatments. But, you know, we're already at the far end of the scale of being treated very poorly, so anything would be an improvement. But so here's my question. If these people have already been sentenced to death, then why does it matter how we treat them? And don't send me hate mail. I'm just asking this question.
Well, I think that it matters because we have a constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And light deprivation and sensory deprivation, I would think, would qualify. And then the people that are on death row have diminished access to religious services, which I think is also a constitutional right.
Right.
So I would say it's just a general decency thing that we would. Yes, they are on death row. That was the sentence of the court. That was the law of Oklahoma. But their sentence is death. Their sentence is not torture while you're waiting for the actual death to occur.
But we, the people, have decided that that's how we want them to be treated. Otherwise, we would have made up something different.
Don't think the average citizen knows or even thinks a whole lot about this, when a person's taken off to prison. I mean, when's the last time you thought about Governor Blagojevich and what kind of conditions he's in and the maximum unit is a federal prison in Colorado. Nobody thinks about what he's enduring.
Is he at the crazy place in Colorado?
Last time I looked him up on the BOP website, that's where he was.
Good grief. I've seen some documentaries on that place. That place, like the Supermax?
Yes, that's the last time
God.
I looked him up. So
that's a terrible, terrible place for sure.
But I don't think the average person thinks a whole lot about it. These people on death row, and they're forgotten about until we hear them on the news that they were executed.
Frankly, I would be willing to bet that the more common response from the public would be is like, hey, they did their crime, then, you know, that's what you get.
Well, that probably would be the common response is this pales in comparison to what they did when they killed somebody, because
Right.
to be on death row, you did kill somebody. And some of the murders are very heinous and
Correct.
gruesome. But that's not what a civilized society does. We don't try to extract the same torture that they inflicted. That's just not what a civilized society does.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right, then let's move over to our onelaw.com article for the night. This one is sort of a silly article, and it's Long Island judge suspended without pay after pleading guilty to underwear burglary. Larry, please, please lay this one out for me, because this one's funny.
Well, I clicked on it, didn't go anywhere, but what I did read it originally when I dropped it in, but this time it didn't open for me. But
so the guy, the guess, judge's name is Sicale. I don't know how to pronounce Cicale.
I guess he has a fascination for undergarments, from what I recollect from the article.
This one's funny. Sicale has been suspended by the high court last year, but with pay, after he was arrested on burglary charges of going into some woman's house and stealing her underwear. Is there anything else that we're going to take away from this other than the silliness of the crime itself?
This was really just one of those things where it was the oddity of it, but it illustrates that people who are high functioning and have made it in life, when you reach the level of a judgeship at any level, unless you're a part-time, one day a month judge, but if you reach that level, there's a fair amount of work that's gone into getting the law degree, and then positioning yourself in a political process to be appointed or to be elected or whatever the process is. You've reached it, and it goes to show that people that have made it in life and have everything apparently going for them, they too are afflicted by compulsions and disorders that need treatment. I don't think we'd like to spend a whole lot of money locking this guy up for a long period of time. I'd like to see him get better. You know, going in people's houses without their permission and taking their garments is just probably not the best thing for anybody to be doing. It's All a right. little, it's a little discombobulating when you go to your underwear drawer and they're missing. What you think?
I remember having 10 undergarments and now I only have 7. Where'd the other 3 go?
I have never experienced that as a problem, but I can imagine it would be a little discombobulating.
Yes. Well, you know, there's always the sock problem with your laundry that, you know, you put in 2 pairs of socks and only 1 sock comes out. Or not 2 pairs, but 2 socks and only 1 comes out. And you're like, where did they go? So maybe the dryer is starting to eat underwear now.
So, well, it would be particularly discombobulating if you had figured out that someone had been in your house and people can feel there's some little something changed and people can feel that there's been an intrusion. Even if
Certainly.
It's not ransacked, people can detect that someone's been there. So
yeah.
That would be discombobulating. Then you go to your underwear drawer. Oh, this is what they took.
Yep. 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 And you might not know for a week or two as you start getting down to the bottom of the drawer or something like that.
So yeah, this was a humorous
Larry,
one,
is it
but also sad.
Go.
I said, this was a humorous one, but also sad.
Yes, of course. It seems that there are a lot of state fairs this time of year. Is that for some reason I've never really noticed this before, but you have yours out there in your part of the country and there's a bunch going on here. And then apparently there's another one in North Carolina. I'm just wondering, is this the time of year for state fairs?
It is. There's the time of the year where the weather's about right. And the fall fairs tend to be they run fairs all carnival runs all year round, but not all year round, but all the warm months. But the fall fairs tend to be the best draws. And I know I always tend the, for several years I've attended the North Georgia Fair, which is a very large fair there in suburban Cobb County, not too far from you, what, an hour and a half from you or so?
Yeah. Something like that. All right, but this article comes from WSOC-TV, and this is zero tolerance warning issued to sex offenders if caught at Cleveland County Fair. So Cleveland County, North Carolina, has all their security cameras and all their cops on the watch looking for people that are on the registry going to these fairs. They have some sort of prohibition from them going. Is this for only people on supervision, or is this anybody that is on the registry?
It's anybody on the registry. And I was getting my hair cut today, and I was talking to the stylist who has a teenage daughter, and we were talking about the teenage daughter is struggling a little bit with weight. She's not obese, but she's struggling with that. And I said, well, Mom, I hate to tell you, but you've been a part of the problem. She said, I've what? I said, you've been a part of the problem. I said, just think about how overly protective you are compared to how when you were raised. I said, you don't let her go anywhere on foot because they're sexual predators grabbing at children and teenagers. I said, they don't get to hang out at the mall. They don't get to, I said, well, she's on cheerleading. You have to take her to practice. You have to pick her up. I said, you're a hovercraft all the time over her. And I said, that's part of the problem. I said, you have contributed. She says, well, I have to protect my daughter. I said, from what? Right. I said, I was at the fair and there was all this hoopla about protecting people from sex offenders. And I said, when is the last time you've heard of anyone being sexually abused at a fair of any? Well, she said, I've never heard of it. And I said, well, then why can't your daughter go to the fair and hang out and have a good time? There's cameras everywhere. There's mounted cops everywhere. There's undercover cops everywhere. Why do you have to hover over her? And she said, I've never thought about it like that. I just want to protect her.
Yes, of course.
Well, that's what all this is about here. This is feeding into the public. The public is just chewing this up. When this is on TV, I think you have a clip that you could run if you wanted to. But this is feeding into to people like that parent who they're convinced that their child is in extreme danger, and that they love this, that the law enforcement is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in overtime to protect them from a non-existent threat.
All right, well, let's do that article, the news clip.
Security if you head out to the Cleveland County Fair.
This year, they want to weed out people who most certainly should not be there. We're talking about sex offenders. Our Ken Lemon just spoke to the sheriff, and you basically asked Ken, how are they going to be able to find sex offenders in the crowds?
Well, Scott, what they're going to do is they're going to reach out to officers who know the registered sex offenders the best. Parole and probation officers are going to help deputies patrol the fairgrounds out here right now. The sheriff says that this is one big playground. You can see the crowd already here. He wants to make sure that no one upsets that.
Sheriff Alan Norman wants to get one clear message to registered sex offenders.
Zero tolerance. You come to the Cleveland County Fair, you will be arrested on site.
The official grand opening is tomorrow, but there are already children here on the rides holding their parents' hands as they make it down the midway. It is the largest county fair in the state. The sheriff said a good day for fun won't be disrupted. He's inviting fairgoers to help identify registered sex offenders.
There's a registry that you can actually go to, not only on our website, it's linked in with the state website.
He said as many as 36 officers will be in the crowd, ready to respond and keeping their eyes open too.
They're constantly looking.
There are also cameras monitored around the clock. They showed me how they can zoom into a small area in seconds and track anything or anyone out of place. State law prohibits sex offenders from going to any place designed for children, like fairs or playgrounds. They haven't had a problem with sex offenders at the fair before, but the county has a problem with registered sex offenders.
We have overabundance of what we normally should have, a county this size, but we're in excess of 300.
There's only one full-time officer assigned to track them, so the sheriff wants to take extra measures to keep an eye on them.
I don't know what the draw is, but I can assure you that we're policing them as responsible as we possibly can.
And any registered sex offender that is arrested here can face a felony that is punishable by up to probation or even as much as 2 years behind bars, depending on that individual's record. And the DA in this case said that he will give his full attention to any registered sex offender arrested at the fair, Scott.
Certainly, it makes parents feel better to hear that. Thank you, Ken.
Good grief. So they're worried about, so they haven't had any problems in the past. This is almost like the first article we covered with the sexting kind of thing. There isn't a problem that already exists, but we're going to make sure that it doesn't become a problem. So they're going to preempt any problems that might exist.
Yes, and how would it become a problem? Do you visualize, our friend Lenora Scanese?
Mm-hmm.
What would you see happening? Okay, there's a teenager at the fair, and the sex offender is going to do what?
He's going to, snatch your kid and carry them like a football and run out of the fair with the 50,000 park attendees just watching in awe as you run out of the place.
Well, I was focusing on the teenagers. We're going to get kids in a moment, the children, because you'd have to snatch those and run with them. But with a teenager, so there's a 16, 15-year-old, and there's a sex offender. The sex offender is going to do what?
They're going to go up to the teenager and molest them.
They're going to say, I think you're hot. And the teenager is going to say what? They're going to say, I think you're gross.
Yes, and go, ew.
And so the sex friend is going to say, well, okay, you're so hot, I'm going to give you some alcohol to get you drunk so you'll be – Yes. So then the kid – so like Lenora describes her speech that she's given. Okay, so you want to snatch a child. Fairgrounds of that size, it's going to be extremely difficult to navigate through with a snatched child. Mm-hmm. To get through all the layers and layers of people and security to get off the fairgrounds with the snatched child. I'm guessing that there'd be a parent or a guardian that would be running along behind you like a dog snapping at your heels and ankles and saying, hey, there goes my kid. I mean, it's absurd.
It is. And also you just described giving the kid alcohol or something like that. And the cost of that would be a really expensive way to try and get a kid drunk.
So it's like, Sheriff, do you really think that you're protecting anything? Because you're not. There's nothing going to happen at the fair. Why can't everybody just go to the fair, including the sex offenders, and have a good time, spend money, enjoy the rides, look at the exhibits, look at the competition with the county fairs like that in the South? They still have competition to win the ribbons for the best home canning. Why can't they be a part of society and have a good time? I mean, they've paid their debt to society in many cases. Why do you have to carry such evil hostility and hatred for forever? Why, Sheriff? Why?
I do not know the answer, other than that we as a society are just evil and mean and cruel and nasty.
So I can't take this anymore.
Oh, there's that gorge. We could send you to the gorge, Larry. We're coming up on episode 100. That could be our big stunt to try and draw listeners, is that you're going to report live from the gorge bridge as you hurl yourself off of it.
Well, then who would do the next episode? Do you have a plan?
For episode 100, that could be the thing.
But who would do the episode?
Well, you'll do it live until.
And then who'll pick up? So we do the whole episode and then?
We'll just shut it down.
Okay.
All right. From Fox19.com, could sex offenders pass out candy to your kids on Halloween? Here we go with the crazy Halloween stuff. This one is out of Ohio, as it turns out, from Cincinnati. And Ohio has a no candy law, which prohibits sex offenders on probation and parole from participating in trick or treating. Is this another problem where sex offenders are actually saying, here, kitty, 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 here are some candies. Come on in my house so I can do terrible, mean things to you.
I have not heard of that being substantiated, documented, and validated that's ever happened. But it's interesting that someone from Kentucky says that we should have it statewide here for everybody, not just a supervised offender population. But it's amazing that we spend so much time working on problems that don't exist. I guess it goes back to the candy scares of the 70s about the razor blade and the apple that nobody ever documented. Yes, but
I recall hearing about it. I don't ever recall. And then all of a sudden, then candy has to come, in all these pre-wrapped wrapper thingamajiggers. You can't have somebody baking cookies given out on Halloween. I do recall a transition at that point.
Right, and people started taking their candy to hospitals to have it examined.
Oh my God!
So they would radiate their kids' candy to make sure it was safe.
That's like the fluoroscope thing from when you were a kid, where you'd have your shoes X-rayed to make sure that your feet were fitting in there the right way. Do you recall those days?
I don't remember that.
It was roughly in the 20s, I guess, maybe the 30s. It was right after the idea that X-rays.
That would be back in Brenda's day.
Oh. Anyway, so yeah, then you would like freaking blast your feet with 10 minutes of radiation so that they could live look at your feet inside your shoes and make sure that there was a proper fit.
Well, I'm assuming that most kids, I haven't watched Trick or Treating for a while, but I'm assuming that there's an adult guardian with most kids. And I would assume if a sex offender snatched them in and they saw the kid vanish into the house, I'm assuming that the adults would probably come up to the door frantically, dialing 911, and I'm assuming they would try to extract the kid from in the house. Wouldn't you think that?
I mean, yeah, and like, I mean, it's not like you have to run down the street to find a payphone. I mean, everybody has a camera and a communication device to where they could call police in real time and go, I'm at address 123 Main Street, and this asshole just picked up my kid, and now he's locked the door, and my kid's inside. How long would it be before cops respond?
Yes, I mean, the whole thing again, sheriffs and police chiefs, it's silly and absurd, and it's really, as far as I'm concerned, it's a disgrace for you to use the resources in such a manner. It's an irresponsible discharge of your duty to do resource allocation in this manner because it's not keeping people safe. There are things you could probably do that would keep things safer. I'm thinking, you know, we always talk about traffic because the kids being hit,
yes,
they don't all die, but there's more traffic accidents as it gets dark, and there's more problem. The problem with kids is usually cars, not sex offenders.
Agreed. And Brian writes in chat, he says, I don't think there are always adults with many trick-or-treaters. Depends on the age, of course, but common to see unescorted groups of kids trick-or-treating. And I would agree with that. My only counter to that would be, it's a group of kids, and I would say that it would seem to be more plausible that someone would try and snatch a kid, not a group of kids. I don't think that you could, like, if, you know, 10 kids doing the trick-or-treating thing, hanging out together, no one's going to try and snatch a group of 10 kids.
Well, that when I said that, I agree about the age. There are probably teens that are trick-or-treating without adult supervision. Even that, like with my stylist, she would be tagging along with her teenager, and her girl's 14. But in terms of when I was thinking about it, a kid that would be snatchable, where you could actually grab and just pull them in, I was thinking more in terms of like 6, 7, 8 year old kids.
Right. You know, and that kid would have to be under supervision by a group of parents. I can't fathom how that would work.
Yeah, I'm guessing that there's adult supervision with most kids that are in the single-digit age. I would dare say that's probably happening. But the whole thing is absurd. It's about our paranoia about the non-existent crime wave that we're not having. If you're alive today, this is the safest time in recorded history to be alive. There's more technology protecting you.
I express that to people that I hang out with, and, like, you know, someone will say, oh, blah, 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 that's not a safe thing to do. And I'm like, is there a possibility that the thing will happen? And yes, of course there's a possibility, but the likelihood is so low. I don't even put it on my radar of something that I'm going to worry about, because if somebody wants to commit the crime, they're going to commit the crime, and there's probably not a lot that I could do. And why then restrict how you live your life of going out to a club on a, like, I just don't see what the viable threat is.
I don't understand.
So. All right. So we're confused. Anybody want to write in and say that there's an actual threat? Let me know. This next article comes from AboveTheLaw.com, and it is this is all you, Larry. Why defendants rarely testify? What problems come up when the defendant testifies? I like the article. I read it.
They get convicted.
Oh, damn it. Oh, Brenda, I'm sorry. I said it again. Convicting is bad, right?
The accused testifying is it doesn't usually pan out very well for them. There are exceptions, but it opens up too many things. First of all, well, the average person's not an expert witness. You can do coaching, but people are not prepared to be under pressure situation and taking rapid fire questions. And And so they just don't hold up well as witnesses. And they come across as non-convincing to the jury. The juror is going to read a lot into a person who doesn't perform well, because all the state's witnesses, these are trained witnesses.
Yeah.
The victims are not trained, and I don't mean to imply that, but all the investigators, the detectives, the beat officers, all these people are in court regularly testifying. And then you have a person who's accused of a crime, and if they have any background at all, the state's going to manage to get that in there, particularly if they open the door by saying, "I would never do something like that." You know, if they make a comment saying, "You know, that's not my character," they put their character in. They say, "Oh, look, Andy, tell me a little bit about your character. You've put that on the table here, so let's talk about your character. Tell us what happened in 1997.
Yeah.
You've got such fine character. Let's hear all about this. Tell us. I'm looking at your rap sheet, and it says so-and-so. Would you like to explain that to the jury? Well, you're the one that opened the door.
Yeah.
Because you weren't trained in what not to say. And despite your lawyer saying, don't do this, in the pressure of the moment, people blurt out things that open the door. And so a witness, an accused taking the stand, usually does not help their defense. Now, those who've never been accused of a crime, they would say, if I was innocent, I would want the whole world to know it, and I would get at the top of the mountain, and I would scream it all over the valley that I am not guilty, and I would tell anyone who would listen, and I would just keep saying the same thing. That's what a person would say who has never been in this situation.
That is what they say. If I have nothing to hide, I don't mind if you search my stuff. It's the same argument there.
Well, but oftentimes people have made confessions. They've made something that can be construed as a confession, and they, when they agreed to be interviewed, because they had nothing to hide, and then what they said would be taken out of context by the prosecution. They would say, "Now you told Detective so and so, I'm reading from your statement, you said this, right?" And, "Well, no, I didn't exactly say that." Well, what did you say?
Yeah,
and it's just not a good situation for a defendant to take the stand in most instances.
And the individual under the pressure of the moment is not going to be they're first of all not so much trained at like the jousting, the debate, the conversation back and forth that you have. Then throw in the extra pressure of the situation of being so heavily scrutinized, things just go south.
They do, and then the jury reads way too much into that, because they've watched smooth presentation from the state, and they've watched a discombobulated, confused defendant who couldn't keep the story straight, and then they've made admissions and concessions, and it just doesn't go well for them.
And you've been in the defense industry since like the Lincoln administration, and you've defended people that. You've been on the defense side of people saying, "Yes, I will stand up and defend myself and get on the witness stand," and it goes south for them?
Well, we try to discourage them in most cases from taking the stand for the very reason. But yes, I've seen people, despite there are certain things the lawyer can't control, and the defendant has the absolute right to testify. They can tell their lawyer to go screw themselves. They're going to testify, and they can plead. That this decision to enter plea is exclusively the defendant's. The lawyers control most everything else. Contrary to what the defendant believes, it's the strategy of the case is up to the lawyer. But in terms of the right to testify, so occasionally I think I've seen a couple of defendants who insisted on testifying, and against advice, and it doesn't end well. It hasn't ended well, and going forward, I would expect it not to end well when they testify. Well, we get to the next article. The police officer in Texas testified, and didn't end well for her either.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And just to close out, Ryan is pre-trial, and he's in chat, and he says, "So I probably shouldn't testify." Good to know. He's one of the rare people that we have communications with before they end up going down this wonderful rabbit hole.
Well, you know, I would certainly defer to his attorney's advice, whatever he or she advises, but. It'd be the rarest of circumstances where that they would be an advice to take the stand. It would be a circumstance where you had absolutely no criminal history, where you truly didn't have anything in your character that could be misconstrued. where you had not made a pretrial statement, and it would be so unlikely that you'd have a person who brings all those qualities together. Now, the police officer, she had all that, and she had to testify in her case because they were going to convict her if she didn't. So she had nothing to lose, and it's kind of like I'll give an example. This will go over some people's head, but like on violating the registry, the registry is a victimless crime. It's a regulatory scheme, and violating the registry, like in my state, it has to be willful or knowing that the violation occurs. You have to be willfully in noncompliance or knowing in noncompliance, and you have the right in our state to appear before a grand jury. That's an absolute right. As a target of a criminal charge, you have the right to appear at a grand jury. Most people don't put their clients on grand jury because it only takes 8 of 12 to issue an indictment, to issue a true bill. And so and anything you say at grand jury can be used against you. Well, in the case of the registry, it took me a long time to convince attorneys that this is one where you can actually do it, because if it's a technical violation where a person has been in compliance for the last 7 years and they've reported in every 90 days and they missed it because the sheriff was sitting there with a stopwatch and it went 1201 on the 91st day and they went down and got a warrant, that doesn't show, since there's the willful or knowing element, it's difficult for the state to reach that high barrier of showing that the violation, noncompliance, is willful or knowing. So you bring that articulate person, and if you've got somebody who's not tattooed from head to toe with screws and bolts and nuts and everything all over their body, that's just the reality of what the juror is going to see. I don't make the rules for life, but you bring a person in who's reasonably presents well, reasonably speaks well, and they say, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I do have a duty to register as a sex offender. I have faithfully complied with that obligation for the last 7 years. I have to report every 90 days. This requires me to take off work, and I've done that dutifully. And I have been as compliant as I possibly can be." They have this system where there's no reminders that come out, even though the law of the state of New Mexico requires reminders to be sent out. And I let it slip off my calendar. I calendared it wrong, or I failed to calendar it, and I went down on the 92nd day, and they were waiting to arrest me. I am sorry this happened, and I will promise to you that I will develop a better system, and it's not going to happen again. The worst thing that's going to happen is they're going to indict you. That is the absolute worst thing that's going to happen. There's also a really good chance they may no-bill that person because they see a human element. They see the overreach of the sheriff's department. They see the stopwatch of them just waiting with bated breath to prosecute someone. And a lot of those cases get no-billed. So the worst case scenario is if you don't show up at grand jury, you're going to get true-billed. If you show up at grand jury, you may get true-billed, but you may not. The chances are very good that you'll get a no bill. And so once lawyers finally understood that, they more and more of these cases, they're putting their client on at grand jury, and they're having them tell the story of how they've been compliant. And we're winning those cases left and right. And the sheriffs are becoming a little less happy about bringing these cases when they're sitting there waiting with a stopwatch because they're being shown to be who they are, which is looking for a problem. And they're trying to create a problem of a person who's been compliant, and they're looking for an "I got you" moment, and we're showing that up to the jurors of this state that's what their law enforcement resource is being used for, is to do "I got you" moments.
Fascinating.
So there are cases where you can do it in limited circumstances, and again, this is one of those limited circumstances where the risk is worth the reward, and you don't have a victim. There's when you have a victim crime where the victim's there, they've testified at the grand jury and they're waiting to see if the grand jury is going to indict, and the prosecutor and the victim's advocates are waiting there, and they're waiting to hear what the jurors are going to decide, if they're going to give them justice. There's no victim with the registry. It's a paid salaried person who's on staff, and it's a regulatory scheme, and there's nobody out there that's going to go home disappointed if there's no indictment. I mean, of course, the officer's going to be disappointed, but there's no victim there. And it's a whole different makeup dynamic in play. So lawyers out there, they're listening. Don't be afraid. Grand juries can be your friend in limited circumstances. But as a rule, you would not want to put your client on a grand jury on most offenses. You would not want to do that.
Right. And then, oh, I guess we get to go back to the New York Times. Murder rate drops across the U.S., but not in all large cities. This reports and provides different sightings along the way of how the crime rate has reduced over the last 30 and 40 years. And in a couple, you know, one-offs here and there of different cities like Chicago. But I think Chicago has come down, but it has been a pretty heavy rise in the recent years. But otherwise, this article just covers about how much violent crime has gone down. I guess the other big point about this article is that they've increased the scope of what they consider to be a quote-unquote sex crime. So sex crimes are up in reporting, which I think would be similar to how they've increased the diagnosis of autism, which is part of the contributing factors to the rise of the autism rates in the United States and around the world.
Possibly. But of this, there are some cities, Baltimore is another one, Chicago, D.C., where violent crime has been up. But as a general rule, if you don't live in one of those cities, if you live in average America, you're safer now than you've been at any point of your life.
Well, let me twirl my head around and go, those are lies, like the person did at the conference in 15, I guess it was.
I believe I remember that, yes. So, well, perhaps they are, but I don't see it that way. I feel safer being alive today than at any point in my life.
Do you possibly think that that's a, I wonder, just from you living for 17 centuries or whatever it is your age is now, that you have witnessed your own personal view of the world has changed, that you just either don't care, like not care, but like you're not concerned by it. Maybe it's just your own personal bias that has changed, that you think you're safer.
I just don't see the crime that people, our city has a higher crime rate than many cities, but even within our higher crime rate that we have here, which is lower than it was at its peak in the 90s before it started going down, but it has risen in recent years. I just don't see I see property crimes that are related to drugs, to addictions, but I just don't see all that. I know we're on track to set a record number of homicides this year if the trend continues, but I just don't see that. I guess I just don't hang out in the right circles to be around all these people. But it's like I asked my brother, who's when I was visiting, I said, okay, you crime is so bad. I said, do you know anyone who's ever been burglarized? I said, not something you've heard of. He said, no. I said, well, do you know anyone who's ever been raped? He said, no. I said, do you know anyone who's ever been physically assaulted? He said, no. I said, well, then how is it that crime is so horrible and you're living in a county of 100,000 people and you know more than anybody that I know? I mean, more people know him because of the uniqueness of him. And you don't know a soul who's been a victim of a burglary or a violent crime. I said, he said, well, I know that just last week that they robbed a bank and they beat up the manager. And I said, yes, but you didn't know those people, did you? And I said, well, we had people getting robbed in the 70s and probably more so than today, where people got beat up and the managers got tied up. And I said, but in terms of, you don't know a soul who's been a victim of crime, but yet you're so paranoid and you're thinking about wanting to have a security system put in that you can't afford to protect yourself against something that has never happened to you in your entire life. Do I have that correct?
Yeah. Well,
all of his friends are the same way. You know, they're just spooked out about something that hasn't happened, and they're spending they got these Ring doorbell apps, and they can talk to people at their house. Yep. And they feel so good when the doorbell rings. They say, "Oh, can I help you?" And they're watching their work, watching their app when somebody goes in the yard. I mean, they're just happy as a lark that they're doing that.
Yep. So, oh, you know, a quick little story on that. I bought, like, there's an extension for my cameras that I bought that are super cheap cameras, but they now I have little, they're stick-on contact sensors so that I know when the door opens. And within maybe a week of me putting it on my back door, I'm at lunch. I just walked up the street to go to lunch, and I got a notice that my back door had opened. And I was like, what in the possible, I'm starting to freak out, and I'm like, you know, I would probably see something on the camera because I don't have a camera towards the back. And I got home and the contact sensor was on the floor. It just fell off. But my heart sank. I was like, oh my God. But no, nothing.
All righty then.
From NPR, ex-Dallas officer who killed a man in his own apartment is found guilty of murder. I still struggle in reading this article and hearing about the story is how did she not know? But I guess just from being, you know, you're a cop, you're at work all day, you're dealing with all kinds of crazy situations that cops might have to put up with. I don't know how you end up on the wrong floor. I don't know how something along the way doesn't trigger that you're in the wrong place, that she then sees that there's an intruder in her house and she shoots the guy who was in his house. She was in the wrong place. She was the actual intruder. But that's the short version of the story, I guess.
Yeah, this story fascinated me because, you know, I'm one for police accountability. And I was wondering when this case went to trial. I commend the district attorney in Dallas for bringing this case to trial. And I'm wondering, you know, we've seen so many police killings that, in my view, were not justified. The circumstances did not warrant their deadly force. We've seen them shoot them off the sides of the mountains here in my city. We've seen them shoot them on the floor in the back in Las Vegas hotel lobbies. I mean, in the hallway, they weren't in the lobby, but we've seen all that. And I was just wondering, okay, now this is a police officer intruding into a man's home who's minding his own business. And she tells him to freeze and to show his hands, and she blows him away because he makes a sudden move. Of course, if someone's intruding your home, of course you are going to make a sudden move because you're going to want to try to protect yourself. And I was wondering if that would cross the line to whether we could actually get a conviction. And the answer from the jurors of Dallas is yes, it did cross the line. So we do know now that although you can shoot them off the mountain, you can shoot them when they're crawling backwards to your voice, you can shoot them when they have a steak knife. We know that all those things are justified. You can give them rough rides, you can choke them out, and all the things that cops have gotten away with. You can shoot a teenager with Laquan, whatever his name was. We know all that. But there is finally a boundary. You can't go into a man's home and shoot him dead in his own home and be exonerated. So I think we now have established there is a limit of where the police can be, where they will at least be held accountable.
We often talk about this idea that they have, you know, it's not an infinite number of alternatives. She could have backed up. She could have, you know, it says in the article that she lived just a short distance away from the station. She could have backed up. She could have called in. She could have just, like, you know, guarded the door to make sure that the perpetrator doesn't leave, quote unquote, her apartment. And I keep saying all that knowing that it's not her apartment, but she had alternatives that, hey, other cops could have come in and they could have been like, dude, why are you in Chickie's apartment? And they're like, this is my apartment. She lives downstairs. Oh, and everything would have just gone away.
So, I agree with you, and I feel bad because that's the downside of the stand your ground laws. They encourage people. I'm not saying you should have to flee every situation.
Right.
But self-defense is a defense that is asserted when you have no choice. And the point you're making is that she had choices. But Texas is a big stand your ground state because we don't want the hooligan to rule the day here. We want good law-abiding citizens. We want them to stand their ground, and they don't have to retreat. But this illuminates the downside of stand your ground. Had she backed off, had she called for backup, the man would be alive today, and she would have realized, and she could have apologized to him, sir, I'm terribly sorry I entered your home. I intruded on you. I'm sorry all this police power came in here. I'm sorry we scared you to death. Oh, this is awful. But she didn't do that.
Nope.
So I didn't sit through the trial. I'm assuming that the jurors did justice, that the evidence was there. I mean, we all know that the bullet came from her weapon, and we know that. But now, quickly, when she got convicted, I quickly shifted gears because at that point, the defense comes out in me, and the defense attorney's job is to minimize the damage of the sentence. And the defense did a darn good job on that. They kept her sentence down to 10 years, which is pretty good.
Sure, because she could have gotten life, correct?
I think she could have.
She could have gotten. I think it was a minimum of 5 to life is what she could have gotten. Brian in chat says she's going to serve at least 6, I think.
And so they did a splendid job. And this is what we claim we want as advocates. We want an individual to not have one event color their entire life. She apparently lived a good life.
Yeah.
She made a mistake, and she got held accountable. She was convicted. But all of her life was taken into account in its totality, and 10 years seems like not an overly harsh sentence and not an overly lenient sentence. If she's going to serve 6 years, she'll think real hard about pulling the gun on someone and telling them to freeze in their own house. I'm sure she'll give that consideration next time.
Yeah. Let's move over to the LA Times, where we're going to talk about bail reform. California voters are divided over bail reform, polls find. This feels scuzzy to me, Larry, because there's a lot of talk in this article about the bail companies are we're doing the sponsoring of getting the referendum to pull this back. So that's obviously they're in a slanted position where this is impacting them directly. That they're then, you know, it's a conflict of interest, I guess is what I'm trying to say, that they are driving the public opinion of getting the petition signed to get this as a referendum so they can have bail again.
Well, I think it's spectacular that it's that the polls are showing it roughly tied. I think it's spectacular that there's that much, because the law that this is seeking to undo was signed by former Governor Brown last year. This is the industry striking back, saying you put us out of business,
right? Where's government's role in pushing back against like a big business, big industry kind of thing versus their own personal objectives of getting rid of this system, which disproportionately hampers people of lower means?
Well, and there we've talked about this before. I'm kind of torn on this because the systems that replace turns out not so be so spectacular either, because of the rubrics they use to determine the tool that they use to assess people,
right.
And they end up having to go through these hoops to get out of jail, and oftentimes they're losing their jobs because they don't have the opportunity to post bail, because they have to go through the hoops of determining if they're a threat to the community and what level of supervision and who's going to be responsible for them and when do we have a slot in intensive pretrial supervision available. Some people sit, we have, for example, here we have what do they call it, since I don't work in direct representing defendants on the front side much anymore, but we have a system where they're committed to the jail, but they go out on home confinement, and it takes a long time to go through all the assessment to be on home confinement, and by then you've lost everything.
Yeah, house arrest, or is there some sort of pretrial house arrest?
Yes. Okay. And so what level of pretrial detention they're going to put on you? What level of pretrial supervision? I misspoke. What level of conditions to assure the safety of the community that they're going to impose on you? Remember, you're presumed innocent.
Right.
Why?
I was just going to suggest we should do something like the TSA pre-check. So you should get pre-approved to be on house arrest.
You're right. But why should you have all these ridiculous conditions imposed on you when you're presumed innocent? Why should you have to do all this stuff? You just simply have an accusation hanging over your head. So I recognize the horrors of cash bond and how it discriminates against people who lack means, but I'm also aware of the systems it replaces and the horrors that they bring in of people being trapped in detention and they can't get out.
Right.
So this is going to be interesting to see how the vote goes of the people.
But Larry, it just, you know, you wouldn't be like the prosecutors are so overworked that they wouldn't try and charge you with a crime that there isn't enough evidence to support. So you must be guilty if they've charged you.
Absolutely.
Why are we even talking about this anymore?
So
please clear the air so someone doesn't take us out of context. Please clear the air.
So that's what people who have never been involved with the criminal justice system, I would say most of our listeners have believed that the prosecution and the cops are overworked and underpaid, short-staffed, and have all the disadvantages. And it's only when you see how well-resourced they are, when they can fly people in from all over the country to testify in a civil commitment proceeding and spend tens of thousands of dollars over a two-week extravaganza, then you realize that maybe the system's just not short-staffed. And when you see these To Catch a Predator and this thing that we talked about at the beginning of the episode, you start figuring out that maybe they're just not as short-staffed as they say.
Tell me this, from you working on the government side of things, when the police want to bring in those kind of resources, does that then pull resources away from some other budget item Do they just then say, hey, we had these run over, so we need to get more funding next year? Or does someone then have to go, well, shoot, we don't get to buy pens and paper this coming year because we brought in this expert witness these extra times? It feels like it would just be something that you don't really budget for gas because you just have to have all that you need. So is it? Does that make sense?
You do. And it's both. It does cause responsible decision makers to question whether or not they justify it. But if you're an elected to the legislature, try voting against a supplemental request from the Department of Corrections when they've run over budget and used a bunch of overtime. Tell me how that plays out for your political career. Vote no on a supplemental request and see what happens.
Yeah, I know that Brian Kemp here like excoriated Stacey Abrams over her voting against a bill that would have enhanced restrictions against our people. And when you actually like drove down, she didn't agree with the policy, so she voted against whatever it was, and I don't remember the details of it. And that's not really the point. Just to bring some sort of names to the example. And so yeah, then you see ads running. Well, Stacey Abrams voted for sex offenders, you know, to decrease your safety in your neighborhoods or some, you know, silliness like that. But it's completely mischaracterized that the enhancements wouldn't have improved public safety at all. And so, yeah, just to answer your question about your political careers, that, you know, someone's going to use that record and then throw you under the bus and potentially mischaracterize what you voted for or against.
Well, but you were talking about in terms of a budget. So I was talking about in terms of supplemental. So you go over budget, you have to go back and ask for a supplemental. And they do it at all levels of government. County commissions are faced with supplemental requests from their agencies, and states or at the federal level. You know, Trump could not do supplementals for the military fast enough after he got into office. He requests a supplemental appropriation. But try voting against one of these supplemental requests. So the Department of Corrections of New Mexico, say, for example, they have a $100 million budget, which is way more than that. And they go over budget, so they get to March, April, and they see that they're going to spend $100 million, then they request a supplemental. They ask the lawmakers for a supplemental appropriation. Vote against that and find out what happens to your political career.
Right, and that's only the example that I was making. All right, well, then I hope you did your homework on I don't even know what to call this. It's in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Did you have time to do some research on this, on the GPS thing in Wisconsin?
I glanced at the complaint, and I think it would be a great one for us to have Adele Nicholas on.
Oh.
Have we had her as a guest?
No. I don't even recognize the name, to be honest with you.
Well, we've had her on Narsil in Action, so you facilitated her, our parents. She has been on us more than once on Narsil in Action Cause. But she would be a great one for this. This is her and Mark Weinberg's case.
Okay.
They're based in Illinois. But they are alleging that those people who are required to do GPS after they've done their time, that's unconstitutional. And that the courts are ruling that around the country, because the U.S. Supreme Court said in Grady in 2015, a case out of North Carolina, that clearly it's a search. And to just arbitrarily engage in a search and seizure is too much. That's not a reasonable interpretation of the Constitution. So this would be a great thing to have Adele on to talk about.
Very good. And this came to us, so we got a new patron and wanted us to cover this particular issue. And just in my reading of it, and I'm like the stupid layperson, it just looks like, hey, these people were convicted a very long time ago, and then they've added these extra quote-unquote civil regulatory scheme stuff to where these people have to wear GPS monitors, and you can't do that.
That's I'm looking forward, because I want to do the same litigation here. We have a statutory requirement here that it doesn't extend beyond your supervision, but anyone who's on a period of post-prison supervision, which we call parole, they have to be attached to GPS for the entire duration of their parole, which can be anywhere from minimum of 5 all the way to life. And it doesn't have any individualized determination of the necessity and the benefit. It's just by statute. And the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled this year that a statute like that, without any differentiation, without any due process, without individual analysis, is unconstitutional. So I want to go into to this challenge saying that our statute is unconstitutional. So GPS for the patron is on our radar, it's a big issue, and it's big business. There's a lot of money made off GPS.
Certainly that.
And I know our capitalist people out there are in favor of capitalism working, right?
Well, certainly. So, I mean, if you can divert people from being in jail or prison and have them with GPS, right? Isn't that what we would shoot for? I mean, you're at least out. You're not inside.
Well, if that's what we're actually doing, but that's not what happens.
Sorry, that's me baiting you, Larry, leading you down that path.
If that's what we were actually doing, if GPS was being used in lieu of incarceration, I would be all for it. But that's not the way GPS is being utilized.
Is there anything else that we need to cover before we head out of here, Larry?
No, we've been on too long.
We have. We're at 1:45 now.
That's right. And nobody's going to listen to the whole 1:45.
I seriously would think that almost everybody will listen to all of it, Larry. I believe that to be true.
All right. Well, how do people reach us? And how do we make this podcast grow? We're not quite up to that doubling the patrons by the end of the year. We're supposed to be at 100 by the end of the year, so we've only got just shy of 3 months to do it.
Right, and I'm pretty certain that if we get you jumping off the bridge on episode 100, we would be able to double our patronage by then.
All righty, then. That'd be a sacrifice worth taking.
All right, well, first of all, to find the website, you need to talk to Al Gore and have him help you learn how to do a Google search so that you can find registrymatters.co. And I'll let you do the phone number because you know it by heart, finally.
Nobody calls anymore, though. 747-227-4477.
And we do have one listener named Tech Addict. I'm not sure if he responds on the website or emails me directly. I think he does it off the website. But he sends emails and articles all the time. And that is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And we love all of our patrons. We love all of our listeners, but especially the patrons. And how do they support the podcast? How do you become a patron and get all the perks and coasters and fridge magnets?
Well, you go to www, if anybody uses that anymore, patreon.com/registrymatters, and that's patreon.
Super duper fantastic. Larry, as always, I so very much appreciate your time and your knowledge and your expertise and all of that. And I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Well, thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure to join you. I hope to be back next week.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Good night.